Follow Mooney Goes Wild on Twitter
at Nature RTE.
In tonight's episode of Mooney Goes Wild, your carbon footprint. Do you ever consider it, and how can you reduce it?
Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. A very busy show ahead of us today. We're going to talk about the holiday season, which will soon be in full swing with around 2 million Irish people heading abroad for some much sought after sea, sun and sightseeing. And who can blame anyone with no sign of any stable summer weather ahead in this country, according to reports from Ed Aaron. But as the country busily packs its bags for top destinations such as Spain, Portugal and America, how many people will actually pause for thought and consider the cost of their personal carbon footprint? Have you ever stopped to think about your carbon footprint? I have four people in the studio. I'm going to ask them now. Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens in Ireland. Have you ever considered your carbon footprint? Just a yes or no answer.
Yes, I have.
Richard Collins, zoologist and world traveller. Have you ever considered your carbon footprint?
Yes, when I was growing up.
No, yes or no?
Yes, absolutely, yes, all the time.
All right. Aine and Ilana, have you?
Yes, I have considered it indeed, Jarek.
Oh, and it hasn't stopped you travelling. Terry Flanagan.
Yes, I have indeed.
You really considered it before you travelled. Can I ask you now generally, Aine? Before you travel, you actually stop and think about it.
I do.
Be honest now, please.
Yeah, I do, and I think, God, this is terrible, but I go anyway.
Why? Why doesn't it stop you?
Because you won't be able to go abroad if you can't fly. That's the problem with living on an island. And therefore, if I want to go abroad, this is what I do, because this is what the point I make about it all the time. It's St. Augustine. Make me pure, but not yet. Make me green, but not yet. So when I've seen the world, when I've ever done, I'll be going around saying, oh, you shouldn't be going on airplanes. But I went in airplanes when I could. And it's only since the 1960s Irish people have been able to do this. Before that, people couldn't go on planes. So it was two generations.
Because they couldn't afford to.
And there weren't that many planes, and it was all more difficult to do and everything else. And there
mainly because they couldn't afford to, let's be honest about it. Well, couldn't get out of the island, yeah, off the island, rather.
Well, there weren't that many planes going either to go places. There were only a few places that they actually flew to directly from Ireland, to be fair now, indeed. But nonetheless, the thing is that people want to have climate change ameliorated, and I'm as good, bad as anybody else, but we don't want to reduce our standard of living while doing this. And air travel is just one example. There are other examples as well of people who wish to have the green agenda followed by everybody else, but not them.
Richard?
Well, I excel in rationalisation, Derek, and trying to find excuses for what I do, you see. If you take the global picture, something like 82% of the world's population have never been in an aeroplane. Irish people, according to Aer Lingus, 6.7 flights per year per Irish person. Now, that is a damning indictment, as they say. But we are an island. That's the first rationalisation. We can't go by train, as some people recommend. If you were in Paris, you'd go by train everywhere. But unfortunately, we're on an island, so we've got to get into a plane anyway. If we went in a ship, the actual footprint would
be
worse.
The boat Holyhead.
They say, for instance, that the footprint for an aeroplane, for worldwide, per aircraft, is around 2% of global of artificial global emissions. For ships, it's around 3.5 to 4. So,
but most of them are not passenger ships.
That's the first rationalisation. The second rationalisation is we can compensate. We can make good our carbon footprint, but we're doing other things now. I'm going to boast now, Derek. Recently, I signed a contract to put 8 electrical panels on my roof.
Well, it took you a long time. For a guy who's an engineer, surely you would have known about this a long time ago. You could have done it years ago.
No, the problem a long time ago was that the equations didn't work out. The things have modernized now. This is not just hot water pipes. This is actual electrical units that are triggered by the light, photoelectric cells. So it is a different thing now. This will cost, I won't give you the figure, but it's considerable. And it will more than compensate for my terrible sins flying around the world in aeroplanes. And I won't see the benefits, because at my age, I won't live quarter long enough to get a return on this. It will be bequeathed.
But you're the one who's always going on about your wonderful grandchildren, and you've taken them here and you've taken them there.
Yes, yes. There's the other side of this.
Yeah, so, I mean, how can you justify travelling?
Of course,
I mean, there's
can.
No need to travel to see exotic bird species nowadays. A bird of paradise, for example, when you can watch a documentary on TV where somebody has gone and has been able to show you these wonderful creatures. You don't have to travel there to see
that's
it yourself.
That's looking at it selfishly. They remember.
Well, the selfish thing is to travel, surely.
No, no, you protect the birds. This is the next rationalisation. You protect the birds by travelling. If you go to these countries, the locals think you are nuts coming to their country with costing a fortune to look at their animals, birds and plants. They think you must be mad. But once they begin to see that they can make a living out of their animals and plants, they then protect them. If we ban international travel to Africa and South America and Southeast Asia, huge industries will begin to suffer. Industries which are conserving
global
these
warming,
animals.
Richard. As I understand it, Aina has her lava in the air there. Hang on a second. But as I understand it, if there's more emissions pumped out if you're in a plane up in the sky than on the ground if you're traveling by train or on the sea.
It's even worse if the emissions are pumped out away up there.
That's what I'm saying. So you're flying to these places. Matthew was flying to these places. Matthew was flying to these places. Terry's probably flying.
Derek, you didn't answer the question. Ever think when you're flying of it?
I'm asking the question.
No, but I mean, you're one of a panel now. You're here the same as the rest of us.
Yeah, no, I can answer I will answer it honestly.
So answer.
Because every time I go, you can put a few bob by to offset your carbon footprint. And mostly I don't, because I don't know where that money's going. But I do other things. I do things at my home and I do want to travel, but I've cut down on the amount of travel I'm making. For sure this year. I've travelled to much fewer places and I travel now when there's a need to travel, when I'm going to do something specifically or I want to see something. So, yes, I'm as guilty as everybody else, Aina.
You travel by car.
I'm not wearing angel wings, believe me.
The penalty is 66 grams per kilometre travelled in a motor car. Interestingly, Ryanair published figures last week in which they claimed that their passengers average out at 66 grams per kilometre travelled, precisely the same as the figure you incur when you drive your car, which you do a lot of. When I go to Cork, I go on the train. When you go in the car.
Because I'm usually carrying equipment and bits and pieces that have to get me from A to B and take them off the train, etc. can be a little bit awkward. That's the reason I travel in the car.
You need a bit of exercise. Besides, it's only the weight of a handbag. I've seen it and carried it from time to time.
You're full of it, Richard. Absolutely.
You are a disgrace.
Don't throw it back on me. And you're the one who does most of the travel.
See not the beam in thy brother's eye till thou pluckest the mote from thine
eye. Isn't this the problem? We'll all preach about it, but people are doing it. Why can't we have staycations, which became very popular during the bust? I'm just putting the heat on you two for the moment because you're the regulars. Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens in Ireland. So you just come back from the Galapagos. Well, before that, I believe you came back from, was it Kew where you met the Queen?
Well, I briefly popped over to the Chelsea Flower Show.
Chelsea Flower Show, yeah.
Sorry. So again, yes, a hefty footprint. And flying all the way to Ecuador and back from Peru is, you know, essentially more than halfway around the world. However, like a lot of people will point out, is the benefits that can be brought to a country. Now, this is not to say, you know, I can offset all of that carbon footprint from the travel that I've done getting there. But one of the amazing things about the Galapagos Islands is, you know, Ecuador does a thoroughly good job at ecotourism. Some of these islands in the archipelago, they're 20 miles across, and the maximum sort of landing area is little trails, maybe three trails per island, each of them only 2 kilometres in length. It means you're actual sort of footprint on those islands is minuscule. So you're looking at something that is pristine. You're paying a high price for these trips. You know, those cruises around the islands are very expensive, thousands of euro. But one of the huge advantages is that Ecuador sees the value of keeping them pristine. So in a sense, one can assuage one's guilt of the distance you've gone because you are contributing towards something that will be preserved.
Terry.
Well, just picking up there on Matthew's point, like, I think he's looking at it from kind of a micro point of view rather than a macro point of view. Yes, the islands are pristine, but look at the carbon footprint that you've expended in getting to there. I mean, when I was younger, I used to say, I'd love to go to the Galapagos Islands. It's something I'd really like to do. And the last number of years, I've changed my mind. I don't want to go. I can see enough of it on the telly. Like, I do think I don't have to go there. And in the last couple of years, I've cut back on travel. And I've cut back on it for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons is because of the environment, because of what's happening. And nowadays, if I want to go somewhere and I want to see wildlife, I'll do it in Ireland. I don't. The last couple of times I've been away, it's been with you, Derek, on the programme. And we've gone to some great places. But there's an equal amount, if not better amount, of wildlife here in Ireland that you can go and visit and that you can go and see. And I just think at times, we don't highlight that. We always want to be looking at David Attenborough. We want to look at all these fancy islands and the sea.
No, don't include me in the we. We highlight a lot of Irish wildlife stories on this programme. That's what we do, day in, day out.
No, I'm not saying we, the Mooney programme, absolutely not. We are the complete opposite. But I'm talking about people at home, when they turn on the telly, that's what they like to watch. They would like to watch all this about...
Escapism, Terry.
Well, maybe it is, but they don't think of the cost. There is a huge cost in it. So, do I travel as much now? No, I don't. Am I happy with that? Yes, I am. If I want to see David Attenborough, I really enjoy looking at the programmes. I'd much rather watch them on the telly. I would much rather, too, that we do the Irish wildlife and nature, which we do, and highlight that and get people in Ireland more interested in looking at the nature and wildlife and everything that's here
in
Ireland.
Can we tell people to cut back on their travel, that they shouldn't do it?
Well, just a point there, Terry. Interesting sort of point about the history of woodlands in Ireland. In counties Waterford, parts of Wicklow, we have the biggest forest cover today of native woodland. The reason being is there were ironworks in those counties, and the oak forests were needed, coppiced oak, for producing charcoal to smelt iron, required woodland management. Therefore, woodland was valuable. It was essential to the economies of those counties. And the legacy of that is they are the most heavily wooded counties to this day. So there you can see those woodlands were useful. Because when to humans something is useless, they don't care about it. They don't look after it or protect it. So here we have a situation where to Ecuador, the Galapagos Islands are useful for their tourism potential. If the tourists stop coming, then they would change them to agriculture, fishery ports, and so on.
So we need to get more tourists coming to Ireland to look at our cliffs, look at our seabirds, because when you do go away abroad, the thing you realise, I mean, I was in Spain there recently, and I'm going to maybe talk about that later on, but they have no sea cliffs, they have no seabirds, they have no vast areas of wading birds in the winter like we have. We should be shouting this from the rooftops and encouraging people to come and see, and the money that they spend coming here enables us to conserve it the way the Galapagos are conserved by the Ecuadorian government, but we're not doing that at all. What good? You can't eat the scenery. You can eat the scenery, in a manner of speaking.
And it's not just the cliffs and the seabirds, but take the sea itself. Well, what have we got? Almost or a little over a quarter of all the whale and dolphin species in the world swim in our waters. Yep. So why can't we get more people to come and see that here, or even for us to see it instead of us travelling abroad?
And the skill is in making sure that when they come, they don't destroy what they're coming to see. So you need those skillful models of ecotourism that work.
In the Galapagos, you meet Americans, Europeans, Australians, New Zealanders, yes, Israelis, and everybody. The one nationality you never meet on the Galapagos, at least it's 19 years since I was there. Was there any other ones?
This survey that you're going to speak, Catedra, is based on one trip 19 years ago.
Based entirely on one trip 19 years ago. Good. Now, the interesting thing was not a single Ecuadorian tourist was to be found anywhere. And then whenever I meet an Ecuadorian, I say, have you ever been to the Galapagos? And I have never met one that was there. Now, the reason is, of course, that it's too expensive for them to go there. They just simply can't afford it. And you find this is kind of developing in the Skelligs as well. I went to the Skelligs long ago for a few quid. You got a boat with a fella and I can take you out in a boat for a few pounds. But now it's a huge sum. I had 9 grandchildren down in Kerry for a few days there recently. And the sum to go out to the... Well, I didn't do it because I was afraid they'd fall off the cliffs out there, the youngsters. It would cost something like €500 to bring the whole lot of us out there. I mean, it's getting like the Galapagos. Only the rich and powerful, the great and the good can access many of these great sites, and this is happening around the world. It becomes an exclusive thing. It's kind of, send out the Kipling line which goes, take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed. That kind of an imperialism has been transferred from an imperialism of politics into an imperialism of conservation. Only the great and the good can now go to the lodges in Africa, where it's prohibited. You and I were there in the prohibitively expensive game lodges out there to see the animals. This is the way there's a tension. It's very hard to see how you can get around this. You know, because once you let the doors completely open, the whole place floods. And it gets like, say, the Alhambra, which is a disaster because thousands of people, the authenticity is lost. It's just, you go to the Louvre, go to Versailles Palace, and you'll be in hordes of tourists. So the atmosphere is gone. So each man kills the thing he loves, you know, and we kill it with the camera.
What are you suggesting? I know what you're saying, but what are you suggesting?
I'm pointing to a difficulty about ecotourism that needs to be addressed, and it is hard to see how these two difficulties of exclusivity for the great sites and the damage that they do, that there's something like 2.7 million people track through Pompeii every year. I mean, the place suffers from this. So you have all these...
Well, that was Frankie Howard's fault, wasn't it, really?
Just to be fair on Ecuadorians, one of the reasons that Ecuadorians find it very difficult to travel to the Galapagos is that you have to get essentially an internal visa, because salaries are double in the Galapagos Islands that they are on the mainland of Ecuador. And that's to do with the perversity of the number of wealthy tourists visiting the Galapagos. So to travel as a Ecuadorian is actually extremely difficult. To prove your bona fides that you are not going to linger afterwards and settle into the Galapagos Islands. So that is a strange little local thing. But I agree, the whole problem of going to see what we love and thereby destroying it, it is a matter of managing that. If we go to the Burren, most of us will go to Karen or Mullagh Mór, and they are wonderfully empty. The villages, you go up to Ballyvaughan, it's full of people, and that's excellent, because that's how tourism should be run in a site like that. To preserve the pristine nature of the Burren, you want the countryside to be empty and the villages to be full. And I think naturally that has evolved there. There were attempts, you know, to put in the great interpretive centre at Mullagh Mór, and everybody recognised this was going to destroy it. And Matt Ridley's most recent book, The Evolution of Everything, talks about government-imposed or society-imposed ideas versus things that have evolved. And essentially, tourism has evolved very naturally in County Clare. And I think the end result is very successful. When you come in and say, right, we're going to spend millions on developing some tourist attractions, that is disastrous because it doesn't necessarily benefit the local people.
I must take you up on that though, Matthew, because you're saying it all ended up very happily, only because people put up a huge fight. Do you not remember that Burn Action Group?
But that's the evolution.
People didn't just realise this was wonderful and did it. It was over the... Those people put their houses on the line to get that thing stopped because it was going ahead through thick and thin, and it took a long time to actually change European law to get it done. So, like, credit where credit is due.
Oh, absolutely,
please.
But it wasn't the evolution.
From anybody. When just saying what happened.
Yeah, but no, he made it all sound like it was the
evolution.
They all realised it and it was wonderful.
Yeah, but evolution is a very bloody process, and essentially everything goes to the wall unless it's working. And that evolution, yes, has had a very crooked route. And like you say, it was extremely difficult, but the end result is it has worked. And what has worked well is that it has evolved rather than being imposed. When something is imposed is when it goes wrong.
Just going back to a point there that Richard was talking about, getting to these places, it's almost becoming elitist to get to somewhere like the Galapagos. And you're paying big, big bucks. And then so many people want to go there to be able to tick it off their bucket list. That's what I feel. And they're not really going for to see whatever it is, the blue-footed booby or whatever it is.
They want to take a selfie while they're there.
That's exactly it. And when they're at the next dinner party, oh, this is where I was, and look, here's me with the blue-footed booby and the whatever albatross it is they're with. And I think that's wrong. I think that's terrible.
Well, let me contrast Ecuador with Peru. I went to Machu Picchu and I enjoyed it along with 6,000 other human beings. And it is a very bizarre, totally different experience. Mm. You have to enter a sort of Zen state of mind so that you can appreciate a remarkable sight. but you are literally being jostled. You can't really move. People are, like you say, taking selfies and so on. The appreciation of what these people are doing, a lot of those people could be sitting in front of a television and watching it at home, and they would have been just as satisfied. And it is, yeah, it is very depressing. Why are people going there? Because you have to tick it off your list.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there are other people there who are essentially not taking photographs, they are experiencing something wonderful. And this sort of dominance of photography, of selfies, is bizarre. It is bizarre.
Doesn't mean that people who aren't taking the selfies aren't experiencing something wonderful too. And maybe they leave there with an appreciation for the place and they'll think twice about decisions they make in the future.
I enjoy watching other humans around the world. I mean, it's one of the lures, really, of travel as well, is seeing other human beings in completely different cultures. And when you see their faces drop after they've taken their photograph and then they spend the next 10 minutes sending out tweets or adjusting their social media, you do think, are they really experiencing the place, or are they actually seeing Machu Picchu on their little mobile phone screen and not really appreciating it, not looking at it? When we used to travel with our children, I used to get them drawing books and pencils every time we got into another city somewhere, and we would spend time drawing things. And it means they've got to sit there for half an hour, 45 minutes, drawing this cathedral or something. And their attention to detail at the end of that is extraordinary. They have spotted tiny little details because they sat there. Now, this was in an era when mobile phones didn't exist. And so, yes, it was a lot easier. But that pleasure of actually sketching and looking at things, so you're really looking rather than this strange second-hand experience.
But it's all about not just getting the experience, it's passing it on. Look, I was here. The photograph that was on the telly there, or on the newspapers there a couple of weeks ago, on was it Mount Everest? And the queue trying to get to the top. I just thought, I know, what's that all about?
Yeah. So, Matthew, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde, he would say that the coward does it with the kiss, the brave man with the sword. And you're saying that the tourist kills the thing he loves with his camera.
Yes.
And his phone.
Yeah. It's a great shame, and it is one of the sort of, you know, problems of new technology. Some technologies are incredibly helpful to us, and one can see now that something like the mobile phone, in all sorts of aspects of our life, has a different impact, and that includes tourism in a major way.
Are we not being elitist here, talking like this and talking about people who go and tick off their bucket list and they take photographs, and you're being a bit snobby about, look at them over there taking their pictures. They're not even enjoying it. They're not even looking at the bloom and thing. Why do they come here? How dare they come here? We're the scientists. I don't mean me. I mean you guys. You're the scientists. We have a right to be here. We're studying it. We're learning from it, and we're passing on that knowledge. We're being elitist.
It's a form of imperialism. The tourist venues are now great imperialist treasures for the great and the good from the first world. But what's the solution? Well, I think the solution is the raffle. Raffles are very valuable things. And if instead of admitting people because they have lots of money, we were to limit the number of people going in and raffle.
Well, that's what they
entries.
Do if you want to go and see the brown bears in Canada.
Yes. Or Newgrange, actually.
Yeah. But isn't that what they do? If you want to see the brown bears in Canada, your name has to go into a lottery. And if your name comes out, because they limit the number of people who can actually come and see the brown bears on the feeding grounds. Yes. And that's the way they do that. So we should do that with the Burren and everywhere else in the world, do you think?
We have to go in something like that direction. As Matthew says, the cognoscenti lose out. The people who know about the place are swamped by bored. I see them in art galleries abroad. People who've never been in an art gallery in their lives are wandering bored around the Louvre or the Prado or something like this. They don't know what they're looking at. They don't care, but they have to say they were there. That sort of thing. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, because if you took me to a football match, I'd be the same. I don't know who scores a goal in tennis or how you clock up goals in tennis, for instance. So it's always taken me to Wimbledon or that other place where they play the golf. I don't know anything about these things. And when these people, when they go into...
And so you don't go?
Oh, I never go, but I have
So you think these people shouldn't go to the Louvre and have that cultural experience when they're travelling to Paris? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that
it sounds like they shouldn't.
No, I'm not
they're
prescribing.
They're sprinting actually in the roof now. I'm not prescribing.
Sine nobilitas isn't that a term. Anyway, you're going to say something.
We were talking about eco-miles and how we could... And now we're talking about people who are stuck up going around spending loads of money.
All right. Well, anyway, you spoke recently, Aina, to former President Mary Robinson, founder of the Climate Justice Foundation. The aim of her foundation is to secure justice for people who are most vulnerable to the impact of climate change. Mary Robinson believes every individual must take responsibility for their personal impact on the planet. And you asked her about the measures she has been taking herself.
The intention is right now. The implementation is going to take a lot of political, both courage and a lot of dialogue. It's got to be cross-party. It's got to be, this isn't a one-sided thing. This is something we all have to embrace. And that's why I think we need to even make it personal in our lives. That's why I became a pescatarian, a new word to me. I only eat fish. I don't eat meat anymore. I'm not saying everybody in Ireland should stop eating meat. That's what I'm doing. I'm not even going to go further and become a full vegetarian. That'd be too much for me at this stage of my life. But what I'm doing is I'm doing something personal that affects me because I like meat, especially lamb. No more, because I care about my children and grandchildren. You know, what I want is everybody to kind of do something, do more recycling, care about your waste, maybe walk or cycle or take public transport, whatever it is, and then get cross with governments for not doing enough. Because you're doing your bit, why isn't government doing more? That's what I want to hear.
Yes, because the food industry globally actually emits 50% of our greenhouse gases.
And an awful lot of it goes to waste.
And, you know, the gases from the globalised food systems, these, you know, there are other techniques. We can recarbonise agriculture. We can plant more trees.
There are great ideas for that.
We can plant more trees. I mean, we don't have to starve.
No.
But, I mean, there are ways, and we don't have to waste food, as you say.
Mm.
But, I mean, we don't need to be getting fish that's farmed in Vietnam, as I was offered the other day, pescator or not. I mean, you don't have to be eating fish that's farmed in Vietnam.
Yes.
And that's air miles. But what about personal air miles?
Yes, I mean, I travel a lot. I try now to send my voice when I can, if it's just to take part in one event, and if they'll accept that I can record and send. It's wonderful how you can do that. But if you want to persuade, and I'm in the persuading business about climate justice, you have to go. My foundation offsets, as it's called, my air miles. We calculate and we send to organisations that are planting trees, doing good work for sustainability. And there's a lot of information about that for anybody who wants to offset their miles if they're, you know, if they're conscientious about it. You can do that.
Former President Mary Robinson speaking with Aina Nilana recently. You want to say something, Matthew?
I think one of the points of offsetting on travel, there are good organisations like the Tree Council of Ireland that are far better places to send your money than little startups on the internet where they claim they're going to plant trees. The overheads of those organisations are designed to profit those organisations, whereas something like the Tree Council is a charitable organisation that has a mission to see further trees planted in this country. And I would recommend people target that over anything else.
And other NGOs that are in the country, if it's not just about trees.
Absolutely. But it's, you know, trees are one way of locking up carbon for a very long period.
Yeah.
However, you know, they might be eventually felled, used. New trees can be planted, and an organisation with a long history is to be favoured over any other.
Well, I would wholeheartedly agree with that, being Vice President of the Tree Council myself. And we do plant trees all the time. People, we have a family tree scheme. People can send in money on the website and we will plant trees for them. And as you say, even if the trees are felled, the timber in the furniture, in the houses, in the buildings is holding that locked-in carbon, because trees are made of air. They're not made of soil. They're not made of the sun. They're not made of water. They're made of carbon out of the air. And the only way to get carbon out of the air is by photosynthesis, by growing trees. And a fully grown tree contains 5 cubic metres of carbon, which is the equivalent of 5 cubic metres of CO2. So it's a direct equivalent, one from the other. And a fully grown tree with 5 cubic metres of carbon in it is the amount of carbon that a family with two cars, and a house used in 1 year, even though it takes 40 years for that tree to grow. So the equivalent, so plant trees. But I mean, this year, for example, was the most successful National Tree Week we ever had, and people planted trees all over the country. They were all up on the website. They had their events in every single county. We went through the whole business of people using their mobile phones to tell others to come out and plant trees. Mm-hmm. I was down in Kilrush planting a tree for every child that went into primary schools. I was down in Kilcock. There were 700 years their bridge was. They planted 700 trees down there just because it isn't highlighted on the daily news, because nobody wants to hear the good news.
Like, if it was highlighted more, and if people were saying, oh yeah, this is a really good idea, and I think people are very much aware now, they're thinking green, now is the time to strike.
Right. Anyway, I asked you all at the beginning, did you consider your environmental impact, your carbon footprint when you travelled? And apparently the reality is that most Irish people don't consider their environmental impact of how they plan their trips. So says a national Red Sea survey conducted on behalf of Travel Counsellors Ireland. The survey said 57% of Irish consumers don't consider sustainability when organising a journey. However, younger travellers appear more in tune with greener tourism, with 62% of females under 25 saying sustainable travel would be one of the aspects they factor with holidaying. The issue of air travel was high on the agenda when Dr. Richard Collins, that you, Richard, spoke with John Sweeney, Emeritus Professor of Geography at Maynooth University and climatologist who's been at the forefront of climate change research on the world stage for many decades now.
Have you a new set of 10 commandments? To bring it down to a very practical level, do you see? Should, for instance, the fourth commandment be, thou shalt not go touring, no tourism from now on, thou shalt not take a flight when one could go by surface transport, all those kind of things, one shouldn't eat red meat. Have you a set of propositions, practical propositions, which the believer, such as myself, should undertake to observe?
Yes, I think it's very dangerous to preach to people, and I think I would be the last person to preach because I'm as big a sinner as anybody. But yes, I mean, I think it's very important that we don't come across as a holier-than-thou person. We all have personal responsibilities to follow. And yes, there are certain things which we will have to consider our actions in the context of. And yes, I do try to eat a little less red meat, and I think that's no harm for me, both health-wise as well as climate-wise. I do try to travel by public transport where possible. I think many people are now beginning to go down that road as well. In terms of travel and tourism, though, I would be the last person to suggest that we should become insular in Ireland or insular in the world, because I think we do need to interact with our other countries and our fellow people on the planet. It's the only way we can ensure that we don't end up fighting each other. But what is important is that we develop sustainable means of transport to do that. And we have sustainable means of transport beginning to emerge in terms of our personal transport. We have an emergence, I think, even in Ireland, of a greater stress in public transport. And we have to look to aviation as the last big hurdle there to try and find a sustainable way of flying rather than what we do at the moment. And with all of those things under our belt, I think we can start to say, well, we at least are playing our part. And in Ireland, we have to play our part because we emit about 50% more greenhouse gases than the European average. So in terms of culpability, in terms of climate justice, we should be pulling our weight a bit more than we are at the moment. And therefore, I think, you know, we should be trying to do these positive things to change our lifestyle as much as possible, while recognizing at the same time that there will be problems for people to change, and that we have to help them and adapt to the future climate with.
On air travel, I always think in my fantasies that if we brought back the dirigibles, filled them with helium, they would be a far more eco-friendly way of travelling around. In fact, on ships, ships are very destructive of the environment. Churning up all that water has terrible global warming consequences. Now, if we used sails and took our time, there might be a solution down that road. I can't see any other solution
solution to the aircraft thing. You know, there really is no alternative now to fossil fuels to drive aircraft. But has anyone seen any? Is this just delusional on my part? Has anyone gone down that road at the many committees you were at? Does anyone suggest that sort of thing?
Well, the big problem with the Paris Agreement was that the two sectors you mentioned, aviation and shipping, were not part of that agreement. And this is a great source of difficulty, because if you take those two sectors together, their greenhouse gas emissions are equivalent to Germany or South Korea. So and they are growing very quickly indeed. So we do need urgently some kind of solution to those. Now, there are the beginnings of test flights with biofuels, for example. There are the beginnings of electric motors on aircraft. And I think we will see, as battery technology improves, the possibility of using solar power on ships combined with battery power. It may be some way in the future, but I think it's something that we have to realistically look at as the next big technological challenge. But you're right. At the moment, fossil fuels represent such an enormously concentrated source of power that aircrafts in particular are going to be the last big nut to crack in this problem. But crack it, we have to have. We are expanding air travel so rapidly at the moment that we will undo some of the good things that we're doing terrestrially if we don't begin to tackle it. But it is a difficult one. But let's see how far we get with some of our other policies and then begin to really attack this problem, because that's where a technological fix, I think, should be possible down the road.
With more than a million people in the air 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year worldwide, it's horrendous to think the energy required to keep all that many people, 20% of the population of Ireland, up in the sky. It's mind-boggling to think of. It would be great if we could find some way around that particular...
So where do you stand on sustainable holidaying? Do you consider your carbon footprint when booking a trip? Do you opt to offset your air mile carbon emissions by paying more for your flight? When abroad, do you tend towards renting a car or using a bicycle sharing scheme or taking the train perhaps? Just some of the aspects of ecotourism to consider. And travel writer and journalist Tom Brannock, who has a keen interest in this area, has recently been writing on this very subject. So Tom, you're in Amsterdam. Why Amsterdam, and why is it the eco-friendly capital of the world, do you think?
Well, I guess in the sense that I suppose the Dutch have always been known for being quite pioneering in terms of environmental issues. Even the aesthetic of the very city, it's, you know, probably the most bike-friendly place on earth, you could argue. Very compatible and friendly for electric vehicles. There's even, I saw an ad on my YouTube this morning for promoting green routes, encouraging Amsterdam dwellers to transform their rooftops into to gardens to encourage biodiversity. And a very obvious thing you see when you're in the supermarkets here is the vegan movement taking off. I understand that Amsterdam is one of the best, if not the best city in the world to be a vegan. So you really see considerable aisles of vegan-friendly food in the main supermarkets here, versus it being still, I guess, a little bit niche at home.
Now, you say in your article that as islanders we need to get places, but once you do get to your base, you should consider train travel. How did you get to Amsterdam?
Well, I'd love to tell you that I curried my way over from Cork Harbour, but alas, I had the 6 o'clock flight to Aer Lingus. So, flight shaming me, Derek, I believe is the term that has emerged in Sweden now in light of Greta Thunberg, the young climate change activist. And this has become a bit of a hot topic in Sweden. The phrase flygskam or flight shame has emerged, and I think Swedes on the back of Greta have really started to question their movements in terms of flying, travel. There's even a very successful Instagram account, and what it does is it kind of names and shames influencers and bloggers who travel to all these exotic destinations from Bali to Bora Bora, to take their selfies, as you guys were chatting about earlier. So that's become quite an issue. And even my friend's housemates here in Amsterdam, they've given up flying altogether. They've taken the ethical decision to stop flying. Now, they're Dutch. They're lucky enough to be on a landmass where they, I guess they could technically take the train to Vladivostok or Beijing. But I guess as Irish people, we're a bit more ethically snookered in terms of those decisions, like the dilemma I faced when coming here in the first place. The Eurolines from Rosslare via the UK isn't a viable option.
But you say that when we arrive in a place, we can kind of offset our carbon footprint. Is this what you're getting at? By using environmentally friendly methods of transport when we are there? Is that what you're suggesting?
I guess the ideal is that you're not using any method of transport at all other than a bicycle. But it really comes down to, I suppose, slow tourism is becoming just like this, the slow food movement and slow fashion became a thing in recent years. Slow travel now is really taken off. So I guess people are suggesting stay in one place. Now, that's fine if you're in a city like Amsterdam where you can walk or cycle around. But if you're, for example, a family holidaying in the likes of Tuscany, a car may be more on the cards. But even the likes of, I know many rental companies now, they offer a green fleet of vehicles where you can book either an electronic or a hybrid car when you travel. So that's a neat way to kind of try one of those out, is when you're on your next holiday and to test drive what an actual hybrid or electric vehicle would be like before you maybe consider buying one back at home.
Tom, thank you very much. We're going to talk now to Mark Smith. Mark is creator of a travel website called The Man in Seat 61. Now, the website provides information on rail travel all over the world. Mark advocates that travel by train is not only better for the environment, but often faster, cheaper and more enjoyable for the passenger too. And he joins us on the line from his home in Buckinghamshire in England. So tell me a little bit about the website, Mark, and how the idea came about.
Well, it started because I ran out of things to read on the train home, bought myself a book about how to start a website, and thought, well, what I want to do is obvious. I've found it so easy to take the train rather than plane from the UK to just about anywhere in Europe, but it's become almost impossible to find anyone in the commercial world who'll tell you how to do it. Mm-hmm. So that was the embryonic thought. That was where it all came from, to actually put this information online so people can find it and choose to go by train instead of plane.
But can you? I mean, can you go from Buckinghamshire to St. Petersburg, for example?
Oh, easily, yes. You just take Eurostar from train into London, Eurostar to Paris, and there's a weekly Paris-Moscow Express change in Moscow for St. Petersburg.
Okay, very good. Well, how do we do it from Dublin?
Well, there's a really carefully kept secret called sail rail tickets from any station in Ireland to any station in Britain. And Dublin to London costs €50, and that's pretty much the same price on any day you want to do it, even at short notice. And it doesn't just get you to London. That price is the same if you were going to Canterbury or Brighton or Dover. So you'd buy a sail rail ticket, and that covers your ferry across to Holyhead and your train to London.
And how much more eco-friendly is travelling by train versus travelling by plane, for example?
Well, some years ago, Eurostar did a study. They commissioned some independent research to look at London to Paris specifically. And the conclusion was quite astounding. It doesn't just cut your CO2 emissions by 10 or 20 or 40%. It cuts them by a staggering 90%, taking the train from London to Paris instead of a plane. Now, it depends. Eurostar is electric, of course. Some trains are diesel. Eurostar is high speed, which are quite power hungry. Slower trains are less power hungry, so it varies. But we're talking 80 to 90% less CO2 taking the train instead of a plane. It's quite staggering. In fact, the biggest single thing most individuals can do as individuals is switch from flights, especially short-haul flights, to taking the train.
But it takes much longer to do this. I mean, if you're doing sail rail to London, how long is it going to take relative to getting your flight from Dublin Airport? And people seem to consider that they want to go for a weekend. You really wouldn't go to London for a weekend on sail rail, would you, from Dublin?
Well, the geography, of course, is not as favourable starting in Dublin than starting here in Buckinghamshire. But you have to change the mindset. You have to make the journey part of the experience. And you don't go for a weekend, you go for a longer period and you make more of a trip out of it. I think that it is a cultural shift.
So you add in a day here and there.
Yeah, I mean, the Once you're travelling around Europe, of course, you've got to remember that the one-hour flight actually takes you 3 hours, what with getting to the airport and checking in. High-speed trains can get from Paris to Amsterdam in 3 hours, Paris to Turin in 5 hours. The time saving by flying, if you're travelling around Europe, is actually not as great as people think it is.
Well, I have to say, if I'm ever in Europe and I'm going from one country to another, I always get the train. I think exactly what you've said there. By the time I walk to the train station, by the time the train arrives, by the time the train gets me to the airport, by the time I get to the check-in desk, then get through security and all the hassle that involves, and then you get to the gate, and then the plane, you get on the plane, they close the doors, they take back the air bridge, and then they tell you there's a storm in the other country, we're going to be sitting here for an hour until the storm, which happened to me once, and I said after that, train all the way.
Oh, absolutely.
You're a family man, so you've got children, and you reckon that travelling by train is a much more family-friendly way to travel anyway.
Well, it is. I mean, think of driving somewhere. You turn your back on your kids. They sit behind you. Taking the train down to Italy, for example, with my kids, I think at that time they were 8 and 10, you sit around a table facing each other, and it's family time. And you can talk, and you can look at the scenery, and you can discuss things. You can actually use the journey. It's like when you travel on business. I used to get more work done on a train journey than I did in the office because there were fewer interruptions.
Well, talking about business, the vast majority, I would imagine, of people who are travelling from Ireland, and remember, we are a country, we're an island, and we have to get off this island, so we have to go by plane, in reality, and especially for the business person, because he's not going to put the day on at the beginning and the day on at the end. He wants to get over there to Britain or to get to the continent to do his business and to get back as quickly as possible. So from a practical point of view, for the businessman, I don't think it would work.
Well, it depends. It depends where you're going to, and it depends what your business is, I think.
Does the businessman need to travel in the first place, Terry?
Well, that's,
with modern technology.
That's a very good point.
A lot of times cases can be done over the internet,
can be done on phones and teleconferences and so on. Yeah, I agree.
Mark, your website is fantastic because, you know, having designed and played with websites over the years, it is delightfully lacking in frills that take away from the basic information you are giving to people. So I hope no designer comes along to destroy what you've got, which is a real clean and very intriguing website. I was really drawn into it by logging onto it and seeing all of the extraordinary train journeys, the efficiency with which you can get at information through your website is a great credit to you.
I'm just wondering how you'd get me from Dublin to Oslo to then take the Bergen line from Oslo to Bergen.
It's there.
Well,
you'd
take rail fail to London.
Yeah.
You'd catch Eurostar and connecting German trains to Hamburg, to Kiel.
Yeah.
And the following day, you'd catch the overnight luxury cruise ferry, the Colour Line ferry, which sails from Kiel up Oslo Fjord to Oslo. And it's a beautiful journey. And then you take the train from Oslo to Bergen.
And I arrive in Bergen, and then
it's raining.
Yeah, it's raining, and I think, it's lovely, I've seen it, it's beautiful, it's a wonderful place, but I want to go to the Galapagos now. How do you get me here? These guys have been talking about the Galapagos. Can you get me there, do you think?
I think you'd need a canoe.
Are these personal journeys you've made, or the operators helping you?
Many of them are, over the years, but I made a decision that it would be an information site, not about what I've personally done. So yes, my personal experience goes into it, hopefully the added value to actually improve people's experience of the journeys. But the information comes from various internet sites. There's the German Railways online timetable, which is the best source for train times anywhere in Europe. There is the fantastic European Rail timetable, which is published every month. Used to be the Thomas Cook timetable. And there are various internet sites, obviously the operator's site. So I sometimes talk of my house here being the rail equivalent of Bletchley Park, where we spiffed all the intelligence from around the world and try and distill what's actually happening around the world on the rails.
Why is it called the man seat 61?
Oh, well, that's Eurostar's fault. I looked at the seating plan for Eurostar and decided I wanted a seat that was a nice table for two in first class, lines up with the windows, and it was seat 61. And it became a tradition that when I was heading off from London via Moscow and Vladivostok to Tokyo, or via Paris and Madrid to Morocco, that I would book seat 61 to start my journey off. So when the website started, the name was already there.
Now, Mark, you're talking in the wrong problem, because we are greeny people.
Clearly we're not.
Normal,
we're all travelling all over the place and we can't seem to stop ourselves. We're addicted.
Normal people want to go from city to city. They're locked into cities. But us greeny people are locked into remote, inaccessible forests and lakes and estuaries and things like that. And that means that going by train means you have to hire taxis, and they're worried that the taxi won't come back for you.
Richard,
now
you're full of it.
What does this mean?
If you go by plane, you have to still get
car
to the same place.
No, you don't.
You fly into the rainforest, do you?
No,
since when?
No, if you're a wildlife person, you have to bring a motor car in practice. Because when you get there, you have a real problem. How the hell am I going to get out to this marsh or that forest or that...
I'm beginning to think we can't solve this problem.
We can't solve it. It's very difficult. That's why we should address it carefully and not go for generalisations and fast solutions.
The big tragedy was that... 40 or odd years ago, half the railway lines in Ireland were pulled up following what the British had done with this idea that it was more economical and sensible. So we went from 500 railway stations and stops in Ireland to a mere 200 odd. And Robert Lloyd Prager, you know, 100 years ago, used to take the train after work on a Friday. Saturday and Sunday, he walked across the country. And, you know, that phenomenal book, The Way That I Went, just shows you could look at the whole of Ireland on foot and use the railway to travel down to the country and back up.
The reason why they pulled up all those railway lines is because they weren't making money. They were losing money. It's the same she said in England. What was it, 1963? The Beeching Report, was it?
Well, I think build it and they'll come. Sort of thing. I think if you put it back in, people would use it. Who wants to sit in the car for hours on end?
I do think we're changing. And I do think, for instance, if we take the trains here in Ireland, more and more people are using the train here in Ireland. Take us in the city here in Dublin. Maybe it's because they can't get the car into the city. Maybe because it's too difficult. But if you look at the amount of trains, because I live beside a train station, and there's constantly trains in and out. So I think, yes, the trains are good. What I think we need to do next is to try and encourage more people to use bicycles. We're certainly not using enough of bicycles. And I see that, from school.
There's a lot of people using bikes now, Terry.
Well, I think when I started teaching, there must have been 200 or 300 kids every day cycling in and out to school. Now, probably 10
The Bike
kids.
The Work scheme has been very successful. Though I have to tell you, I was in Arnott's last weekend and a retailer had a little concession in there. They were selling electric bikes. And one of the bikes was 9,750 euro. I have a picture. I'll put it on the website. We're going to do a report in the next couple of weeks for an electric bike, and I thought, who is going to spend? And he told me people are buying them. 9,750 euro for a battery powered bike. I don't know where it's all going to end. Surely to God, it could be a lot cheaper than that.
We're all going to hell in a handcart, Eric. So, you know, we're only juggling the chairs around on the Titanic.
Maybe today, after listening to this, you will at least think about your carbon footprint, think about another way of travelling on that holiday that you're going on. Maybe make it a bit slower by using those more environmentally friendly methods of transport that are already in place. So do you go in the plane, or do you go on the boat, do you go on the train? What do? You're going to use it or lose it, sort of thing. Anyway, that's all we have time for today. Thanks to Matthew Jebb, to Richard Collins, to Aileen Ilana, and to Terry Flanagan. Our researchers are Sinead Renshaw and John Riley. Our broadcast coordinator is Charlotte Holland. On sound, we had Noel Roberts, and today's producer was Sheila O'Callaghan. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney.
Follow us on Facebook, RTE Nature.
Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio 1.